Every lap in under a minute means every second matters. Bosch Power Tools Perth Super Sprint, May 17 to 19. Book now at Ticketek. Supercars, unforgettable.
Hey, it's Chaz Mostert here, and yes, I'm inside your speaker. I'm in here because I have a special message for you from Clayton in Melbourne. If you're a club, state, or national racer on the circuit or on the dirt in Speedway or rallying, you can now tap into the know-how of Walkinshaw Racing Services, and you don't need a supercar to get in the door. The same expertise that's won multiple Bathurst 1000s and V8 Supercar Championships is now available for you to call upon. From bonnet to bumper, WRS can help you with engines, design, paint, machining, fabrication, and so much more for all sorts of makes, models, and categories. Have a chat with Walkinshaw Racing Services and tell them what matters to you. Call now on 1300 W Racing or email services@walkinshawracing.com.au.
A Motorsport Podcast Network production.
G'day race fans, welcome to the Motorsport News Podcast. I'm your host Will Dale, and here's what's making headlines this week. Erebus Motorsport has named the driver of its second car for the Formula One Australian Grand Prix weekend, and no surprises here, it's not Brody Kostecki. Todd Hazelwood will be back in the number 99 at Albert Park while the team's impasse with the reigning champion continues into yet another week. Supercars has confirmed it's going to be doing more parity testing after Albert Park, taking a handful of cars of both marks to conduct centre of gravity testing in the days after the event. It follows all the changes that have been made to both the Ford and the Chevrolet in the 12 months since the last COG test. Canberra was treated to the sound of a supercar last weekend, Matt Stone Racing's Cameron Hill bringing his number 4 Camaro to his home city for a runaround as part of the Festival of Speed event. It's the first time a supercar has been in action in our nation's capital since 2016 when Jamie Wynn Cup blew the motor in his 888 car in the burnout comp at Summernats. Matt Payne will slot in an extra race before the Supercars Championship resumes at Albert Park later this month. He'll join Stephen and Brenton Grove in their Mercedes-AMG GT3 for the Sepang 12-hour on March 14 to 16. Not the Sebring 12-hour, in case you listened to an earlier version of this episode. He's also out at Winton today testing his supercar, and we'll hear from his boss, Grove Racing Team Principal David Couchy, later in the show. And we had an Aussie on the podium at the Bahrain Grand Prix, albeit not in the Formula One race, which we'll talk about later in the show. Christian Mansell taking second place in the Formula 3 feature race. He also ends the weekend third in points. Joining me as always is V8 Sleuth's Head of Publications, award-winning journalist Stefan Bartholomaeus. And Stefan, how nice is it to not wake up to an email containing a bunch of WhatsApp messages from an F1 team principal?
Hello, Will. I feel like you've bowled the first ball of the podcast at me full toss there. I think we should settle into this episode a bit before we head into that topic.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, let's start then with our Stars of the Week. Steph, who's getting yours?
Well, my star of the week this week is actually going to NASCAR for its transparency over the issue of Joey Logano's webbed glove that he ran during qualifying at Atlanta. And that was a story you covered off in the news headlines last week, that this glove had been modified to help Joey deflect air out of the cockpit on his qualifying run. And during the last weekend in Las Vegas, the Cup Series director, Brad Moran, held a media session where he showed the glove and explained what had been done and why it was illegal. And it's obviously a pretty high-interest news story, but it's just great that NASCAR publicly stands up and holds its competitors to account with such transparency.
And holds the glove. Like, it was fantastic seeing the actual photos of the thing with the webbing, not just between the thumb and forefinger, as was originally reported, but in between all the fingers, so it was full, like, Aquaman wet weather spec. The one thing that did jump out at me when I saw the photo, though, you talk about transparency. Why didn't they choose a transparent material for the webbing to try and properly conceal what they were doing?
Oh, it's in hindsight, it's such a bold thing to try to get away with. And one of the interesting parts of the explanation from NASCAR was around the fact it was spotted during a random inspection of onboard footage. Like, normally something like that would come from a tip-off from a rival team, especially in NASCAR where the garage area is so open and there's so many cameras as well.
Oh, absolutely. My star of the week is also headed to NASCAR, as it happens. Not to the organisation, but to the engine shop at Hendrick Motorsports. Now, if you think back to the closing stages of Bathurst in 2002, Mark Scaife and Jim Richards winning despite a whole heap of plastic shopping bags clogging up the air intake of their Commodore, while a very famous Falcon copped one and blew up. Well, in the NASCAR Cup Series race at Vegas, William Byron, the Daytona 500 winner, he copped one of those massive industrial wheelie bin-sized ones over the front of his number 24 Chevy. He'd been leading the race and was a contender for the win, but he eventually had to make an unscheduled stop to get it taken off before the engine cooked itself. He fell off the lead lap and then spent the rest of the race fighting his way back to 10th place. But why the engine shop gets the star is that it wasn't just the bag that the motor had to deal with during the race. So when they brought the car back and inspected the air filter afterwards, the crew found this large chunk of aluminium that they're really confident was originally a beer can. So for building an engine that still performs after a can of beer, Hendrick Motorsports gets my star of the week. Right, let's talk supercars. And as I said off the top of the show, we have very slight progress on the Brody Kostecki Erebus Motorsports situation. The original statement from Erebus weeks and weeks ago was that Brody wasn't going to be in the car at Bathurst, where his seat was filled by Todd Hazelwood. Well, Todd's getting another go round at Albert Park. He'll be in the number 99 TFH-backed Chevy for that weekend. In a short statement earlier today, Erebus said the following: Erebus Motorsport remains firmly committed to respecting Brody's privacy, and we are unable to provide further updates at this time. Todd Hazelwood will continue to represent the team in Car 99 at the Australian Grand Prix event. We would also like to express our thanks for the support we've received in recent weeks. Your messages mean the world to us. Steph, I guess this week isn't the week that we finally get a proper resolution to all this.
Yeah, it's certainly the least sort of newsworthy or enlightening update that we could have hoped for. I don't think there was any doubt really that Todd would continue in the car. So the news, if anything, here is the bit that's left unsaid, and that the standoff with Brody is clearly ongoing and they're still in this sort of mediation type of stalemate. And yeah, I mean, there's just not much else we can say at this point other than the fact that it's just not good for anyone to have this dragging on and on. Like at the moment, we're heading down the path of this update being recycled every round for the next 10 rounds.
I'll just copy paste into the script, shall I? Each week?
Absolutely.
Well, the other notable supercars news so far this week is that it has formally dropped its push to switch a few of this year's races from being lap-based to time-based. So late last year, it emerged that the Wanneroo, Hidden Valley and Simmons Plains events would each feature a pair of one-hour timed races, something that at the time was reported to come at the request of both Supercars Commission members as well as the sports broadcasters. Well, the race formats for those three events contained no mention of the time, only distances when the operations manual was finalised at the start of the year. And Supercars confirmed to V8 Sleuth's Conor O'Brien this week that the commission has had a change of heart, so we'll have races with lap counts in Perth, Darwin and Tassie this year. Steph, is this an opportunity missed here? I mean, we always hear so much from fans about hating when races end up going time certain.
Well, it appears that this was just something where the TV guys wanted it, as you said, and the commission liked it in theory, but there was a fair bit of devil in the detail when it came to accounting for compulsory pit stop rules and red flags and all the rest of it, and the upside just wasn't worth the complexity that it had the potential to add, so they unwound it even though they'd already gone out and announced it. So in the end, I don't think it's going to make much difference because they've just set the lap durations to work out to approximately 60 minutes anyway. And sure, like people don't like time certain finishes, but races like Super 2 at Bathurst where the scheduled time ran out while under a red flag wasn't exactly all that satisfying either.
No, it certainly was not. Like I said at the top of the show, there's a supercar in action on this Fair Tuesday over at Winton Motor Raceway with Matt Payne tackling one of his three rookie days. Grove Racing team principal David Couchy is trackside and I chatted to him earlier today about testing, parity and his two Kiwi drivers. So Couchy, how helpful have these extra rookie days been for getting Matt up to speed and comfortable in the Gen 3 car?
Oh, well, within such a, you know, restricted category, you know, very strict testing rules, three test days a year, it's absolutely, you know, they're very important and you can, you know, learn a lot. The driver can learn a lot and, you know, helps the team as well to, you know, in terms of them working together. So, you know, but they're definitely needed because this is a crazy competitive championship and, you know, bringing rookies into the into the championship is very difficult. It's never easy, and therefore we need to do everything we can to make sure we're giving them the best opportunity to succeed in the long run, and making sure they're just not coming in for a year and getting burnt and all getting spat out.
What does a test day actually look like now in the Gen 3 era? Because, I mean, with so many more control components on the car, do you even get to throw any new bits at it on days like these, or is it just purely about evaluating setup direction?
Yeah, so no, definitely there's no new bits, which is sad from an engineering point of view. It was always nice to bring shiny new parts to the car and test them and understand them. So that part of the, you know, of development has disappeared now, but it's a car that we've only run for a year now, so there's still, I wish I could say we understand everything about the car, but unfortunately we don't. So therefore there's still a lot we're exploring. You know, we've still got a lot of tools that we can use to tune the car, and I mean, for us, we've had quite a few aero changes as well. So you know, and this year is another different aero package for us. So therefore, you know, understanding that, learning that, and then all the bits that to make a package work, you know, might require you know, philosophy changes. You know, something that we did last year that was working might not work with this aero package. So, mate, we're still in a very very deep learning curve.
I was going to say, how much is that aero change thrown out, or stuff that you learned last year? Is there a fair bit that still applies, or is it, like you said, still just a bit of an unknown?
Look, I mean, the honest answer is we are still learning that, because we've done now one test day at Winton and you know, one race meeting at Bathurst. Bathurst is a very, very unique circuit. It's you know, it's an outlier in terms of the majority of the circuits we go to for the year. So again, we are still learning. But change, you know, when we're changing the aero package all the time, that's definitely a hindrance in terms of honing in to the ideal setup window. And I think we certainly suffered a little bit from that last year. And you know, with the sort of changes throughout the season, but you know, so it'll take us some time. It does mean that we have to continuously learn and continuously sort of reevaluate things that, you know, might have been right 3 months ago, that might have worked 3 months ago. They might not work or might not make sense now. So it's just that learning curve. But that's what we're here to try to understand today.
So Matt ended last season on a real high with a strong run on the Gold Coast and, of course, his win in Adelaide. But it looked like Bathurst was a bit of a tough weekend for him. What was going on there?
Yeah, look, I think if Matt's honest with himself, he probably maybe under-delivered a little bit, a couple of mistakes. Certainly, at the end of qualifying on Saturday, that sort of hurt him a little bit. But look, to be honest, we didn't have the car there. You know, we weren't in the window, and when the car's not in the right setup window, then obviously the drivers are trying to find time that doesn't really exist, and that's when mistakes happen and get a bit you know, they can be a bit inconsistent up and down. So look, we didn't really, everyone made mistakes over the Bathurst weekend. We didn't really execute from a car speed and car setup perspective, but we did a good job in terms of executing in the races. We kept it clean, run some good strategies, and had pretty reasonable car speed in race trim, which that's sort of what basically meant we scored more points than most and have ended up second in the team's championship, which is really, really positive for the team. But overall, we didn't have the best package over that weekend.
That being second in the championship, I believe that's the highest Grove's ever been in the team standings. Is it? I imagine that is a nice boost for the team, but is it something that you can't, is a milestone you kind of celebrate or has been noted, or is it more of a feeling of, well, this is what we're working towards, this is where we want to be and aiming to be, that sort of feeling?
Yeah, look, I'm not generally one to celebrate second, I got to say, but look, it is an achievement, you know. It is, you know, it's, I mean, look, it's one round. There's still 11 rounds to go, so we're absolutely not getting ahead of ourselves. It's very, very close. I mean, T8 sort of gapped the field a bit. They had a very strong weekend. And then, you know, from second and back, it's very, very close. So, you know, it's It's very, very competitive, and we've only done one round. So, but look, that's what we said we want to do. We want to march up that team's championship order. We want to have, you know, two drivers that can fight for race wins consistently. And, you know, and but also in terms of championship, it's also the days that you don't have the best car, and those days, you know, they do happen. It's those days that you have to consolidate and still try to get the best result possible for the team to make sure that you're still accumulating those points. And that's sort of what that weekend was for us. I wouldn't say damage control, but we didn't have the best car. There was definitely faster cars than us, but we sort of we didn't make any big mistakes in racing, and therefore came out where we did.
Mm. So Matt's kind of the Grove Racing veteran in the driver lineup this year, with having Richie Stanaway coming in alongside of him. How are those two gelling as teammates? Are you two Kiwis getting along?
Yeah, they are. The Kiwi connection is real. They've got a real respect for each other, and they're hungry. That's the thing I like the most. We've got two extremely determined and hungry drivers, two very talented drivers that really want to win, and then we have to give them the car, and they've got a team behind them that also wants to win. And so that's what's going to drive us forward. But no, those guys so far have worked really good together. They're very different characters in lots of ways, but that's a good thing as well. So they've got, you know, different strengths and weaknesses, and they're bringing different skills to the table. So that overall will make us better.
So just looking at Richie, I mean, plenty's been said about where he's been in his career, his journey out of the sport and back in again, and of course, some not so great stories of his time as a full-time driver previously. What were you expecting to get with Richie? And like, now you've seen him up close and gotten around under the belt, what's your take on where he's at?
Oh, he's probably in the best condition and best state, you know, mentally and physically of his career, probably from what I've seen so far. He's, I think he's been very open and honest with us about his previous attempts at main game driving in supercars, and there's lots of reasons why those relationships didn't quite work out for him. But he was able to talk about those openly with us and be honest about it, and we could see the determination and the hunger in him, and that's why, you know, the talent is never a question about his talent, and that's why we decided to sign him. We signed him before the endurance events last year, and it was nice to see him get some, win Bathurst, obviously. So that was a pleasing moment for him, a massive achievement, and then some validation for us that we've got a guy that really wants to do this.
He had a bit of a blip on the Friday at the 500, though, with that crash just above the dipper. Did that rattle or shake him at all, or was he pretty quick to just push it out of his mind and move on from it?
No, he took that like a pro. He, obviously was apologetic to the team, but at the end of the day, again, I think we didn't quite give him the best car, and he was probably looking for something and some performance that wasn't quite there yet. So, you know, it's one of those one of those things. You know, I don't. If you can name me a champion driver that hasn't crashed at Bathurst, I'll buy a case of beer.
How did Richie's car stand up to the hit as well? Was it all just bolt-on stuff, or has it needed further attention back at headquarters?
No, it was pretty good. So it was just bolt-on stuff. It was actually less damage than we were expecting. Mostly just some bottom arms and then or top arm as well, I think, on the rear. But the chassis held up quite well. We've done a much more sort of deeper sort of strip down now that we're back at the factory, and so far, everything's held up quite well. So we were quite pleased with that.
Of course, that was a brand new car that Richie's
it
in
was,
this year.
Yeah.
That also means you've got David Reynolds' old car from last year sitting at Brayside as a spare. Is there any interest, or has Grove looked at running a wildcard program at all, or is your focus just totally on the two full-time cars?
Wildcards are never out of the question, but for sure, we're trying to really focus on the two, on 19 and 26 and those two cars, and making sure that we execute with those cars as best as we can. And look, wildcard programs, you know, they can be beneficial, but you also got to make sure you're putting the right package together with the right drivers and being able to support it with good people to get a good result. So it's not something we want to do half-heartedly or anything like that. That's not how we operate. So look, there's no immediate plans to do any wildcards with that chassis this year. But you know, also, you know, never say never.
Now, unfortunately, parity talk continues to rear its head in supercars, albeit now more focused on engine rather than aero. Do you feel like the Fords were at a disadvantage at Bathurst?
Yeah, look, we could, you know, from the timing, we can definitely see some clear differences in the straight sectors between the two makes, and we know that, you know, and supercars has been open that there is ongoing work with the engine programs. There was a very extensive aero program that went on over the summer break, and now the sort of same level of detail needs to go into the engine side of things to make sure that those, you know, that part of the car is paratized as best as possible. So look, without question, there are question marks and there are things that don't look quite right, but we need to allow that to go through the right process to get that resolved, in the most scientific and using the scientific way, using the best tools available.
Is it frustrating in the Gen 3 era with the philosophical change of all the engines for a manufacturer coming from the one pool? Is it frustrating to not be in control of your own engines in that sense?
Oh, yeah, it's massively sort of frustrating, especially when you feel like you're not on the right not on the right side of things. So it is, I mean, and that's the nature of a little bit of the nature of the direction we've gone now with one, you know, one engine supplier, and there's a lot of control suppliers and things like that. And sometimes it doesn't quite work out. So, but look, is it right or wrong? Is it the right model? Is it the wrong model? Maybe that needs some more discussion and debate, but, look, definitely it's been a frustrating year last year. There's no question about the frustrations of all the teams, and it's those kind of things. They're not good for the sport. They're not good for either side, because it's not good for even the teams that are, I guess, on the right side of it. Although they're the ones that are, I guess, winning the races and things like that. It just tarnishes the whole sport and everything we do and the achievements of all the teams. So it's just something that we need to resolve once and for all, and resolve in the most scientific and technical way, and take out the politics and emotion.
Very true. Nobody likes an asterisk.
No.
Lastly, looking ahead a bit, how far off are you from locking in your enduro lineup? I mean, obviously you've got Garth Tander on the books. While last year's recruit Kevin Estrie did pretty well over in Qatar on the weekend with getting a win, is there potential for him to be back for a second dip?
Yeah, so yeah, Garth will be with us again this year he's as a driver mentor and also as a co-driver. And yeah, look, we have got some, you know, very solid plans for the other co-driver for the year. And it's something that we'll look at announcing shortly. But there's some plenty of good guys out there that have had, you know, some success in our cars, and certainly success in other categories. And yeah, look, we were really happy with Kevin last year. He did a great job for us, and yeah, obviously he's a superstar, continuing to have some success in the Porsche Penske program, which is great for those guys. So yeah, we'll make an announcement in not too long.
Formula One is back for 2024, but it certainly looked an awful lot like 2023. Max Verstappen and Sergio Perez taking a dominant 1-2 for Red Bull Racing under the lights in Bahrain. The reigning champ was just over 22 seconds ahead of his teammate, who was just a couple of seconds clear of soon-to-be ex-Ferrari driver Carlos Sainz in third, ahead of teammate Charles Leclerc in fourth, while further back it was Mercedes and McLaren battling to be best of the rest, almost 50 seconds behind the winner. Oscar Piastri was the best of the Aussies in P8 and once again was probably quite relieved to have made his switch to McLaren after the two Alpines battled over sheep stations at the tail of the field all weekend. Steph, if you like watching a team and driver at the peak of their respective powers running rampant over the opposition, you're probably in for a treat this year.
I think you nailed it straight off the top there, that it felt more like round 23 of the 2023 season, more so than round one of a new campaign. Like Max obviously just dominating and everyone else fighting for the scraps, basically. And it still seemed quite weird, like, to have no driver changes at all in the off season. That kind of limited the fun new storylines that you normally have going into a campaign, and it just made it just sort of assessing who gained and lost relative to the end of last year. There's obviously plenty of excitement there over Lewis going to Ferrari in 2025, but we've got to get through the longest calendar ever before we get to that.
I'm sure Carlos Sainz took absolutely no joy in beating his teammate to really illustrate the point to his bosses what he thinks of how that's all played out for him. There was also a bit of spice in the battle at Toro, not Toro Rosso, sorry. not that one either. RB. Is that what we're calling it this year? RB? Is that the easiest?
I don't think that's what the team's calling it, but it's what the sane world's calling it.
Yes. So Daniel Ricciardo had fresher, softer tyres than teammate Yuki Tsunoda in the closing laps. And the team wanted him to let the Aussie through in the hope that he might be able to jag a point. Like, they were battling for, I think, 13th or 14th at that point. So he had pace. He maybe could have caught a couple of the cars in front, but would have been relying on a few other dominoes to fall to get into the points. But let's just say Yuki wasn't all that interested to let him past. He fought Ricciardo off for a couple of laps before eventually letting him by, and then vented his frustrations by dive-bombing Ricciardo on the cool-down lap. Here's what was said over team radios after the checkered flag. First, we'll hear from Yuki and then from Danny Rick.
Checkered flag. P14.
Yeah, whatever. What the f*** is wrong? Sorry. I'll save it. Helmet.
That audio from Formula One there. Steph, yes, they were squabbling over a place outside the points, maybe for a point, but not particularly clever if Yuki wants a seat at the big Red Bull team.
Yeah, that was all pretty wild, like especially that cool-down lap dive bomb. You don't see that one too often, but like it just shows what it means to these guys, doesn't it? Like you look at it and go P13, P14, there's no points down there. It's the first race of a hugely long season. So from the outside, it's like the who cares Grand Prix. But on the inside, it's a huge deal and it's a tough job for the teams to manage these situations, and maybe the potential upside of getting Ricciardo to P12 above the Haas there just wasn't worth the friction.
The biggest action in Bahrain, though, came from off the track rather than on it, because first there was that continuing scandal around Red Bull team principal Christian Horner and the ongoing fallout from an internal investigation into his behaviour with a woman who was a staff member of the team. Just to bring, if you're not across it, just to bring you up to speed, the investigation was launched by parent company Red Bull, not the team itself, and involved an independent lawyer, and it cleared Horner of any wrongdoing on the eve of the race. And then a dossier of WhatsApp chat screen grabs purported to be the evidence in the investigation were then emailed to key F1 figures and a host of media personnel the very next day. Some of those have made it to the internet. You won't hear any content from them here, but also I'm not your mum, so if you want to go look for them, knock yourself out. I'm not here to cast judgment on people's personal lives or their relationships and how that works with work and all that sort of thing. But Steph, what all this has done is it's highlighted an interesting power struggle going on behind the scenes within the wider Red Bull family, especially given Jos Verstappen's very blunt quotes to reporters saying the team will be torn apart if Horner stays in charge.
Yeah, I mean, rightly or wrongly, the whole thing had the look of Red Bull trying to shut the door on this whole situation before the Bahrain weekend actually started. And then obviously those leaked messages sort of flung it all back open again on Thursday. And then, as you say, at the end of the weekend, like, Big Jos just stuck his foot in the doorway and really made sure that it's not over yet. So clearly there's a lot to play out, and it'll be big news all week with another race coming straight up. It's just bizarre to have this team achieving such incredible success and yet for this seemingly huge division to have occurred. But I guess it's the year for bizarre bust-ups.
That it is. And the other sort of interesting factor in all of this is that Red Bull has an upcoming relationship with Ford. And one of the other things that was leaked was an email sent to the team with words from CEO Jim Farley, basically pointing to a morality clause in their deal. So that leaves Red Bull in a very interesting situation where, if you look at the key pillars of any team, fast driver, tick, Max Verstappen, very fast car created by a designer, Adrian Newey, tick, and a very good engine, Ford, question mark there as to how that's all going to go. But with any dynasty, it's always interesting to see how they unravel, because they all do in time. And it's fascinating to see that maybe this is the point where Red Bull's dominance all of a sudden starts to fade away.
Well, yeah, there's a sort of fair way to go before, I guess, obviously it wasn't interrupting the on-track element yet. But as you say, with the likes of Ford, everyone has their own interests to protect as well. And that's part of the reason why this really needed to be a robust investigation and an independent one from Red Bull. And everyone needs the confidence that it was in order to go forward.
It may well have been, for all we know, but all we got was the final line of the report saying nothing to see here. So we'll see how all that develops, as you said, during the week before the Saudi Arabian Grand Prix. But that wasn't the only off-track piece of intrigue that has occurred in Bahrain, because separate to all of that, it's emerged today that the president of the FIA, Mohammed Bin Salayem, is being investigated by the FIA for allegedly attempting to interfere with the result of a Formula One race, which is an extraordinary thing to have to say. This actually goes back to last year's Saudi Arabian Grand Prix, and specifically a penalty that was handed to Fernando Alonso and was then subsequently rescinded after the race, restoring the Aston Martin driver to third place in the final results. Per the BBC, which broke the story, the allegation from a whistleblower is that Bin Salayem asked the stewards to overturn their original decision to apply the penalty, which was for the team touching the car in the pits while Alonso was serving a 5-second penalty. We'll see also how this develops over the course of the week. In other overseas news, Porsche has claimed the opening round of the World Endurance Championship at Lusail, the distinctively named Qatar 1812. Matt Campbell put his Porsche 963 on pole, but it was the sister number 6 entry of Kevin Estre, Lorenz Vanthoor and Andre Lotterer that came home first. Despite a tangle with an LMGT3 car in the closing stages that forced them to make a late, unscheduled pit stop to, of all things, put a new race number on the car as the original came off with a big chunk of bodywork. Peugeot's wingless 9X8 claimed second ahead of Campbell's Porsche. It is Porsche's first outright WEC race win since 2019, and they also got the GT3 win with Manti Pure Racing. MotoGP is back this weekend in Qatar, but there's been an early present for reigning world champ Pecco Bagnaia. He's done a new deal with Ducati that keeps him with the Italian mark until the end of 2026. Meanwhile, though, there's reports that the current owners of MotoGP are in talks to sell the entire championship. The price? An eye-watering 3.4 billion euros. And in NASCAR, Kyle Larson took out the Cup Series race at Las Vegas by holding off a charging Tyler Reddick in the closing laps, while Shane Van Gisbergen posted his first DNF of the Xfinity Series season, with engine problems knocking him out after just 30 laps. He'd qualified in 30th place, and it is worth noting that despite the early exit, SVG is still second in the Sunoco Rookie of the Year standings, 36 points behind reigning ARCA Series champ and two-time pole sitter already this season with Richard Childress Racing, Jesse Love. The next stop for the Xfinity Series is Phoenix, which this weekend plays host to the Call 811.com, every dig, every time, 200. Then SVG gets a weekend off before the doubleheader weekend at COTA, where along with the Xfinity race, he'll make his first of 8 Cup Series starts for 2024. Motorsport News mailbag time, and we're going to try and get through a few of them this week. First off, Ashley Yates. Should supercars scrap the Gen 3 chassis and just bring in NASCAR's current cars, seeing as there's so many ready to go over there? Bring the cars here, and then they can run like GT3 do, where drivers can jump between series. Interesting theory. Definitely one that I've thought about a fair few times, but the bit that always pops up in my mind is, well, it's going to make enduro driver changes real interesting with no doors.
True. This topic was obviously brought up by Mark Rushbrook, the global Ford performance boss, during his media time at Bathurst, where he was answering a lot of questions about supercars' ability to achieve technical parity. And he threw this in when he was asked actually about whether GT3 should replace the Gen 3 formula. And he sort of hinted that it'd be cheaper for everyone involved for supercars to just adopt the NASCAR if they can't get technical parity under control. And I could see how it would be convenient perhaps for Ford, because they've obviously homologated a car to race over there in NASCAR. But, I'm not sure that having all our race teams totally dependent on NASCAR and cars coming from the US would be ideal. It would certainly be a sad situation where supercars aren't even built in Australia anymore.
No, that is a very fair point. David Mitchell, do they still have local yellow flags as an option in supercars like they do in Formula 1? So when Cam Waters' tyre fell off at Turn 2, to me, it didn't make sense to do a four-course yellow and neutralise the whole Bathurst circuit when the issue was isolated to one corner. Local yellows would have been less disruptive and allowed the drivers to keep racing on the rest of the circuit. I guess the issue is that you had a runaway wheel, and if it's going backwards into multiple sectors, that does present not just a safety issue for the drivers, but also a safety issue for the marshals that have to go out and chase this thing down.
Yeah, well, I think the reason that the safety car exists is that the drivers can't really be trusted to slow enough under local yellows. No. It just doesn't provide adequate cover for people that have to attend to a wheel, or if there's a car stop, then there's a driver in it and all those sorts of things. So the solution to what David is talking about here is maybe that slow zone system, which is used at events like the Nürburgring 24-hour, where they just limit the speed for a certain sector. And that's more of a possibility for supercars to look at now that they've got this full course yellow technology and system up and running. But yeah, I mean, personally, I think a slow zone just adds more complexity. There's enough different levers for race control to pull in these situations already.
And they seem to want to go about doing these sorts of things in a fair and balanced manner, which if some cars go through the slow zone and some do not by the time it's all sorted out, then clearly some people will get an advantage, which won't really occur as organically under full course yellow. However, Shane Stiles, our next question. Well, it's more of a statement, to be fair. Definitely not a fan of the new safety car procedure. So clearly he's talking about the full course yellow as well. And I would presume in the sense of it, again, not resulting in the field packing up behind the safety car quite quickly and spicing up the race.
For sure. I mean, there's two parts to the new safety car procedure, if this is what we're talking about here. The first part is fine. It gets the cars under control sooner, gets them down to 80 kilometers an hour within 15 seconds, so everyone's not racing back to the safety car. And they might need to fine-tune a bit of that time delay, whether 15 seconds is too much or whatever. They're sort of taking feedback from drivers at the moment. But, the second element, which you're talking about, is running the full-course yellow instead of the safety car. It just doesn't quite pass the pub test for entertainment, really. And the argument for it is that they can fix a small issue like a stray wheel on the circuit without disrupting the race. But I don't know how often that you'd say, oh, no, not a safety car, I was enjoying that. Like a safety car normally adds excitement rather than takes away.
It's one of those things, like when we had James Taylor on this podcast last year, it was always going to be a question of what sort of situations would require a full course yellow. And I guess that's the sort of thing that's only going to get built up with experience of going through them and seeing what sort of instances they can justify using it. Andrew Pifero, they need to fix the issue of finishing under a safety car. Supercars need to have a look at how NASCAR do it. Andrew, one of the things that does help NASCAR with their green white checker process is that they kind of have an endless TV window compared to what we do. So they can have multiple swings at trying to finish a race under green. Whereas at some point, especially with a Channel 7 broadcast round, your free-to-air audience will depart before the end of the race.
I don't think this is a huge issue for supercars because of how rare it is to finish a race under safety car. But certainly, it's sort of another, there's the TV factor, but then it's also a traditionalist versus entertainment kind of argument. Because if you did introduce it, and someone was leading Bathurst at the end of 161 laps and it went to 163 and they lost it, it would sort of feel like they'd been dudded a bit. But, I would like to see them do it if they could get around the TV issue because, there's nothing more flat than a safety car finish.
Well, there's certain races, like all the ones that are exclusively on Fox where your restriction is really the crew on the ground or whatever potential noise limits there might be around a circuit, just thinking of Sandown as an example, I don't see an issue with them having a go. My first thought was Winton, but that's not on the schedule anymore. but some of those smaller circuits where give the crowd their money's worth, give the viewing audience its money's worth and try and get a finish under green. Mickey Smythe, why is the transient dynamometer testing delayed until a bit later in the season? Surely after a few more races, the Ford guys will realise their season is over. That's not good enough from supercars. I think part of it is that it's been such a long process to get to a point of identifying a transient dynamometer that they want to use that all parties are happy with, then the logistics of getting everything there. It's just taken a long time to get to this point. And that's cutting out the whole wrangling over, we should do this. No, we don't need to do this. Okay, yeah, maybe we will do this. Back and forth that was going on for a lot of last year.
Yeah, I think all parties have realized for quite a while that it's necessary. But, getting it done has been something else. And there was a bit of mixed messaging on this whole, why is it taking so long over the Bathurst weekend? Because the supercars position was that there's a few factors, including Ford needing to nail down its final engine spec in terms of getting productionized versions of some of the new parts done, like the pulleys and oil pump parts and so on. But I believe DJR may have a bit of a different view on that, but yeah, either way, the talk is that it's still a month or two away. But the good thing is, the plan is to do it actually at AVL, the people that make these dynos over in the United States. So when it is done, it should be done properly.
AVL dyno specialists, as opposed to AVL, our former host here, Jules Fordnut. I'm going to assume that's a very targeted nom de plume. What happened to Zach Best from Dunlop Super 2s racing elsewhere? Thought he'd tried to move into the main game by now. That is an excellent point as to what Zach Best, who is clearly proven on multiple occasions a class driver, good young steerer, pole sitter in the Repco Supercars Championship, and he's on the sidelines.
Yeah, his story was obviously pretty well told at the end of last year. He got really close to that SCT seat that Jack Smith had vacated, but he didn't quite have enough to get it over the line, and Jackson Evans ended up in that car. And Zach kind of ended up in the situation that quite a few do, where if you've done Super 2 for a couple of years, what's the benefit of doing it again and putting all that budget in to do it again? So obviously his situation was he'd come second a few times, he didn't quite crack it. But at the moment he's out there looking for an enduro drive, and we might possibly see him in another category as well. It's a bit of a shame for him that the key enduro seats are filled, but I certainly think we'll see him on the grid there.
And lastly, Tim Matheson, who has an alternative race format suggestion, eliminator style. So last car across the line, each lap has to drop out. He says, yes, I do love chaos. What made you ask? We've actually run this as a format previously. If you go far enough back in the history of supercars racing, you'll see we've probably tried almost everything. But they actually ran an eliminator qualifying race at the Grand Prix back in 2012, where I think it was, I want to say they culled three cars at the end of every couple of laps, to the point where there was just 10 left, and they went around for a couple of laps. And I think from memory, it was Mark Winterbottom who won off the top of my head.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you're right. But the actual knockout stuff was far less exciting than it sounds. That's my memory of it anyway. And I think the race was a bit of a disaster, a typical Albert Park sort of deal where you had an early safety car and you had mixed compounds on the cars as well at that point. And it ended up, funnily enough, going time certain. So maybe the format didn't get the amount of oxygen that it sort of deserved. But, I can't see them going back to this, especially in this modern era where we don't have non-championship races.
No, although I really like the idea of this as a format. You think of it as an underlights at QR or SMP or a small track of some kind where everyone can see everything. And instead of just having the lowest placed car disappearing, pack the field back up for a restart after each series of eliminations. I feel like that would be an entertaining thing.
We may have strayed too far away from the traditionalist to entertainment boundary line here for my taste, but certainly it does feel like it needed something else, because just telling the slowest car to go home, it just felt like some sort of nightmare where the grid gets smaller and smaller, which we don't need in too many categories, I wouldn't have thought.
No. Now, thank you very much for all your questions to the mailbag. We do want to try and get through more of them each episode as this year compared to years past. So keep sending them in and we'll do our best to get through them. Now, don't forget to show our teammates here on the Motorsport News podcast feed a bit of love, along with hearing from us on Tuesdays. Peter and Luke Whitten from Rally Sport Magazine are back on Wednesday with a new episode of the Special Stage Rally podcast, talking about all things rallying both here and around the world. Then on Thursday, look out for a new ep of the Brad Jones Racing Rundown with the driver of the number 96 Pizza Hut Chevy Camaro, Macaulay Jones, and team co-founder and owner Brad Jones, subbing for BJR General Manager Chris Westwood this week. But for now, on behalf of Stefan Bartholomaeus, I'm Will Dale, and we'll catch you next time on the Motorsport News Podcast.
Every lap in under a minute means every second matters. Bosch Power Tools Perth Super Sprint, May 17 to 19. Book now at Ticketek. Supercars, unforgettable.
Hey, it's Chaz Mostert here, and yes, I'm inside your speaker. I'm in here because I have a special message for you from Clayton in Melbourne. If you're a club, state, or national racer on the circuit or on the dirt in Speedway or rallying, you can now tap into the know-how of Walkinshaw Racing Services, and you don't need a supercar to get in the door. The same expertise that's won multiple Bathurst 1000s and V8 Supercar Championships is now available for you to call upon. From bonnet to bumper, WRS can help you with engines, design, paint, machining, fabrication, and so much more for all sorts of makes, models, and categories. Have a chat with Walkinshaw Racing Services and tell them what matters to you. Call now on 1300 W Racing or email services@walkinshawracing.com.au.